we know for sure is the FBI report did not corroborate any of the allegations against Judge Kavanaugh. And the second thing we know for sure is that there's no way anything we did would satisfy the Democrats.
It looks to be a product of an incomplete investigation that was limited, perhaps by the White House, I don't know. But the White House certainly blocked access to millions of documents from Judge Kavanaugh's record. I know that.
Those were Senators Mitch McConnell and Dianne Feinstein this morning. Was the investigation into the sexual assault allegations made against Judge Brett Kavanaugh handled correctly? Democrats say the FBI was blocked from following up on many leads, but Republicans say the investigation was, quote, very thorough. And you may never know what the FBI found, because the Bureau is not releasing its report. There's a single copy, and right now, it's locked in a vault. Senators were allowed to go into that vault today and review the document, but they're not allowed to discuss what they read. Senate leader Mitch McConnell says the first vote on Kavanaugh will happen tomorrow. Asha Rangappa is a senior lecturer at Yale, and she's also a former FBI special agent. Asha, welcome to Press Play.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So Democrats say the investigation was very limited, that it left out a lot of leads. Republicans are calling it thorough, though. What are you hearing? Which one is it?
It's hard to say without looking at the contents of the interviews that have been done. You know, my sense is that any investigation here would have at least started out with interviewing Dr. Ford and Judge Kavanaugh. That's kind of the logical first step that you would do. And then you would move outward first with immediate witnesses that she alleged were at the party. And then possibly even moving out from there to other people who might have information. And that's just for Dr. Ford's allegation.
And they said this was going to be a week-long investigation, but it seems like they are handing their results in early. Is it in fact early?
They did have until Friday. And again, I think that given that, in my opinion, this would have normally and logically taken more time and would have involved more people, this suggests to me that they were given a restrictive list of people that they could talk to. That's my speculation. But I think that what that points to is also that there should be some transparency in exactly what the instructions were that the White House gave the FBI. Because unless we know that, unless we know what explicit parameters the FBI was working under, we have no way of who came to the decision on who to interview and why, you know, what reasons there might have been that this concluded so early.
So what we know is that we weren't given a list of who was going to be interviewed. They had a week, but they turned in the results of their investigation several days early. For the FBI, how unusual is this way of investigating a situation like this? Is this normal or is it completely unusual?
Well, normally the FBI wouldn't be given any restrictions. So I'm not as concerned with the time issue. I'm more concerned with the freedom issue in terms of the FBI being able to follow all of its leads and having the flexibility to come back and say, you know, this isn't enough time. We have other people that we want to talk to. And right now we don't know if they were able to follow that normal course that they would ordinarily take in a background investigation like this.
So we know the FBI didn't interview Kavanaugh or Ford. Does it surprise you?
Well, of course. You know, you would start with the person making the allegation. You would have them get their story on record. I mean, she did testify in front of the Senate, but that is different. That was not the, you know, the questions that were asked in that setting were not necessarily the kinds of questions that the FBI would answer. They didn't do follow-up questions, for example, or home in on particular details that the FBI might. And the FBI would do that, and they would do the same with Judge Kavanaugh. He was barely questioned at all. I mean, the prosecutor that they brought in was basically, you know, they pulled the floor trap under her pretty quick. So, you know, to do an exhaustive interview of both of them, and that would be able to form a baseline against what which to check other witness statements and, you know, figure out who else to talk to.
Do we have any indication of who they actually did interview?
There have been various reports. It looks like they interviewed Mark Judge. They interviewed the people that Dr. Ford identified as people she remembered as being at the party where she alleged that she had been assaulted. And my understanding is that they also interviewed people who were in attendance on a party on July 1st on Judge Kavanaugh's calendar, which included some of the people that Dr. Ford had named, but I think there were other people as well.
So there are reports that the FBI refused to interview key witnesses, witnesses that went to the press later on with their stories. Why would the FBI refuse to talk to people who claim to have critical information regarding this case?
The background checks are run out of the administrative division of the FBI. They are done for essentially a third-party customer, in this case, the White House. The purpose of the investigation is to check, you know, the subject's background to see if there's any indications of unsuitability for a position of public trust. When that investigation is complete, it is then up to the consumer, the White House, if they want anything else checked, to then ask the FBI to reopen it and do a supplemental investigation. So in many ways here, the FBI is kind of a subcontractor for the White House and is really acting at their request. Whereas in a criminal investigation, they have independent authority under the statutes of the United States to investigate violations of criminal law. So if a witness comes forward, they are absolutely obligated to take that person's statement because it could relate to a violation of criminal law.
They're being so hush-hush with this report. So few people actually have access. Republican Senator Chuck Grassley said the FBI found no hint of misconduct by Kavanaugh. Now, Cory Booker and Chuck Schumer said they disagree. Will the public ever get a chance to hear what the FBI actually found?
If, for example, the House turns over after the midterm elections and, you know, the Judiciary House Judiciary Committee wants to subpoena the FBI and find out what, you know, was going on behind the scenes, they can do that. One thing we've learned is that the FBI documents everything. So if they're getting instructions or if they're being told to do things with regard to a particular task in their mandate, they will make sure that that's noted. So I think right now, it's just purely speculative. I suspect that the White House will not allow this to be seen publicly. So unless it leaks, we won't. But I think that there could be other ways for it to come out later.
You are a former special agent with the FBI. What are your former colleagues and friends at the Bureau saying about this? What are they telling you about this investigation in terms of their reaction to how this is being handled?
Well, I mean, you know, there's going to be only a few people actually working on this. I think the general impression is of frustration because the FBI is kind of being put once again in the spotlight between political agendas of the White House and members of Congress and the public's need to know. And as in any other situation, the FBI is, you know, constrained by particular rules or what they are allowed to do in certain circumstances. And they also can't speak. So, you know, they can't talk about investigations, whether they're background checks or criminal investigations. So they're not really able to come out and give their side of the story either. So I think it's just frustrating for the FBI.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Asha Rangappa is a senior lecturer at Yale University and a former FBI special agent. Coming up, they live among you and they are geniuses. Meet some of this year's MacArthur Fellows. I'm Duarte Geraldino, and that's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play, and I'm Duarte Geraldino in for Madeline Brand. This year's MacArthur Genius Grants are out. The five-year grants are for people who show exceptional creativity in their work, from science to law, education, the arts, and more. Now, they each get $625,000 to pursue their creative projects, no strings attached. And a couple are based right here in Los Angeles. Neuroscientist Doris Tsao, playwright Dominique Morisot, and music composer Matthew O'Coin. Let's start with Matt. Matt, where were you when you got the call?
I was actually in Vermont on a kind of composing retreat with my boyfriend, and I was very close to finishing a draft of the opera I'm writing. So I actually missed the call the first time. I think a lot of us, when we see a strange number, we think, ugh, you know, spam. I can't be distracted by that. So it took a second try for me to pick up.
And what was your first thought? You're only 28 years old. I know you're working in opera, you know, an art that we tend to associate with an older crowd. And yet you get this call and they have crowned you, essentially. What do you do with that?
I mean, I thought it was a hoax, honestly. I mean, it felt like, aren't you guys calling the wrong guy, or, you know, 20 years too early or so? No, I'm really humbled. I did my homework, though, and looked at what the grants are for. The basic idea is, we believe in this person's potential. Let's let them spread their wings.
So for the new season, the LA Opera will have a world premiere of your show. Can you briefly tell us what it's about?
Yeah, it's an adaptation of a play called Eurydice by Sarah Ruhl, who also has some Los Angeles connections. It's a 21st century retelling of the Orpheus myth, very much from Eurydice's perspective. Sarah kind of sees herself in some ways, I think, as Eurydice, and invents this whole parallel story of her in the underworld kind of becoming an amnesiac. And I read this play and just wept. It was so beautiful. So I called her up, and we've been adapting it into an opera. And yes, it will be coming to LA Opera before long.
What are you doing to attract younger audiences to opera?
So I believe that in a world where everything is available digitally and everything is available virtually, the big advantage that classical music has is that it's like organic food. It's made through our bodies. It's made through these instruments that are made of wood and metal. There's this amazing intimacy to it. And I believe that my generation will turn to it, but we have to experience it up close and personal. We have to experience it in people's living rooms, which is how a lot of this music was written to be experienced. You know, this is party music. This is music where you want to be right up close next to a cello, or experiencing what a human voice can do unamplified. So I don't think we need to change the music one bit. We just need to bring it right to your ears.
Now I know why you're a genius. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Duarte. My pleasure.
Matthew O'Coin, composer with the LA Opera and one of this year's MacArthur Fellows. And now to another MacArthur genius, playwright Dominique Morisot. One of her plays is called Pipeline, and it's about a mom who is struggling with the fact that her son fell into the school-to-prison pipeline. Now, Dominique is also a writer for TV. She's written for the show Shameless, about a dysfunctional family. Dominique, congratulations on being named a MacArthur genius. Where were you when you got the call?
Hi, thank you. I was at home. I was at home in my office working.
Now, you didn't know you were up for it. No one knows that they're going to get this. It's like winning some award from the sky.
Yeah, it is. It is. And in fact, they're very cryptic about it. So when they reach out to you, they don't tell you what they're reaching out about. And so I kept getting like strange text messages and things like that about, you know, please call me back. And I'm just like, who is this making demands on my time? you know, so it's like, what is this? And I, you know, I was in the middle of taking care of so many important things. I was a little vexed by it all, I'll be honest.
Now, we're talking to you in L.A., but much of your work centers on Detroit, and that's where you grew up. Do you find any similarities between the two cities?
Well, you know, to me, Detroit is its own unique thing, as is New York, as is Los Angeles, where I'm also living now. And for me in particular, Detroit has always been like a metaphor for the nation, you know. It's also because of where I've grown up. It's also a metaphor for, I think, Black America in a way, because how people have looked at the city has been such a predominantly Black city for so long and for all of my upbringing that when people talk about the city, it's hard to see it disconnected from being in a within a racial context and within a socioeconomic context. So it's always been a big part of my work to explore all of those things when I'm talking about Detroit.
So how would you define your work so that we get a better understanding? What's the force that drives you to create?
Oh, you know, I really care about people, working people. I think people that are disenfranchised or somehow find themselves in the margins, and that's where I center my attention and wanting to bring their stories to the forefront so that we all have a much more human connection collectively when we understand the people whose stories may not be as illuminated.
Thank you so much, and congratulations once again.
Thank you so very much.
Playwright Dominique Morisseau. And our last L.A. MacArthur genius is one of the scientists that Dominique mentioned, Doris Tsao. Now, she's a visual neuroscientist at Caltech. Congratulations, Doris.
Thanks so much.
So where were you when you got the call?
I was at Dulles Airport in Virginia.
Did you believe it?
It sounded real.
So you're a visual neuroscientist. What is that?
Yeah. So, you know, we all see objects in space. And it turns out this is all a result of electrical activity in the brain. And I'm trying to understand how this comes about. You know, how do the neurons in our brain encode the visual world?
Can you explain why some people recognize faces better than others?
Not completely sure, but I've done a lot of work on these areas in the brain that are dedicated to processing faces, and so it's possible in some people these areas are bigger than in others.
As part of this award that you've gotten, it sort of really shines the light on you as someone who's going to lead the field forward. How do you hope your research changes or advances the way we see this?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly what we hope to do. You know, we're on day one of, you know, our journey into understanding the brain. The field is at such an infant stage, and so this MacArthur Award really says to us, go ahead, take whatever risks necessary. So we're really excited.
And what do you see the future of your field doing? How will it impact all of our lives?
Well, fundamentally, understanding the brain can help us become more self-aware, mindful, and happier human beings. And practically, we can use some of the principles we uncover about the brain to build the next generation of intelligent technologies, such as more reliable self-driving cars.
Doris Tsao is a neuroscientist at Caltech. Coming up, actor Javier Bardem doesn't like the fact that brutal drug lord Pablo Escobar has sometimes been portrayed in movies and TV as a cool and powerful, glamorous person.
And when we were shooting in Colombia, people were coming to us saying, please don't do that. Don't do that again with this monster, because we don't want our sons to want to be like him.
Javier Bardem is here to talk about his new film, Loving Pablo. I'm Duarte Geraldino. That's next. This is Press Play, and I'm Duarte Geraldino, in for Madeline Brand. Javier Bardem never shied away from physically and emotionally demanding roles, like playing the exiled gay Cuban writer Ronaldo Arenas in Before Night Falls, or real-life quadriplegic activist Ramon Sampedro in 2004's The Sea Inside. And then there was No Country for Old Men.
What's the most you ever lost on a coin toss?
Sir?
The most you ever lost on a coin toss.
I don't know. I couldn't say.
Call it.
That was Javier Bardem playing psycho killer Anton Chigurh in the Coen Brothers film. Well, his latest character is as merciless as Anton Chigurh, but is not fictional. He plays notorious Colombian drug lord Pablo Escobar in the new film, Loving Pablo. The role required a physical transformation. It's sort of amazing. Prosthetics, weight gain,
I don't know in pounds, but I think it's like 25 or something like that. Yeah, I'm still working on losing them.
Javier Bardem stopped by recently. You know what he told me? That in order to embody Pablo Escobar for loving Pablo, he had to get a sort of rhythm right.
His body language and his pace, because he was very specific in the way he was moving and talking and behaving and relating to others. And I was always fascinated by that in him, the dichotomy between his low-key rhythm, slow rhythm, and horrible actions that he was making. So it was kind of a contradiction in terms.
There's been so much written about Pablo Escobar's life and death. It's been well documented, including by Virginia Viejo's book, Loving Pablo, mm-hmm. Hating Escobar. The movie is based on that book, and it was published a decade ago. Had you been looking at this story for a long time?
A long, long time. The first time I was offered to play Pablo Escobar was in 1998. And back then, I was intrigued about who he was, and then I started reading about it, and I found this extraordinary character to play as an actor, ethically horrible, morally inexcusable. But so since then, I've been offered many Pablos Escobares, but I refused them all because I didn't find they were written more than like a very one-color villain, and that's it. And he was more complex than that. And then I found this book, and along with Fernando León de Aranoa, which is the director and screenwriter, we put it together and we found the angle that we wanted to talk about, which is the difference in this one is, I guess, we are bringing the human being into the picture. Not because we want to justify him or excuse him, but because we want to make people understand that he is not an alien landed from outer space. He's one of us. And we, along with our actions and with what we do or what we support doing by voting and putting governments that are corrupted or by consuming the product, we give wings, we give power to people like him. And I think it's important to take all the glamour and all the coolness of some other readings of on Escobar that has been made out of the picture, because there's nothing cool about it.
Pablo has, he was loved by people in Colombia. What is that complexity that brought you to him and brought so many people in Colombia to this man that really was a monster in many ways?
Well, there are many aspects in it, and the complexity of it is what drew me to make my own angle in the Escobar story. We have to remember that he was coming out of a very misery background in a country where the poor community were not being taken care of. And the detachment from the high class and the government class towards the poor communities was huge. So this man, since he was getting more powerful and richer, a lot of those people that were surrounding him and were looking at him like a, like an example of how to make it, were, yes, not only loving him, but supporting him and protecting him and hiding him, because they truly believed that he was the savior. He was the only one who would really care about them. And he did in some ways, because he bought all these soccer fields and he constructed and built up these villages and houses. And but there was a plan behind it. He wanted to own that support in order to become bigger and stronger and more powerful.
There were scenes where he seems like he is defending people. We know that he eventually takes political office, however briefly, the Colombia's equivalent of the House of Representatives. And he tried to call out the corruption in the existing government. And the Minister of Justice called for his resignation. Here's a clip of Escobar's response.
Maybe you should question your own presence here, Senor Minister, because you don't believe in the justice that you represent. And you want the justice system of another country for our citizens, so you don't deserve your position. You should resign. Yeah.
You have lied today by suggesting that my money is linked to drug trafficking. That's why I'm giving Your Honor 24 hours to present solid evidence of your accusations against me. Actually, you are the one who should explain the origin of the money that financed your campaign.
So did you, after having played Pablo Escobar, after having gotten into this character, do you believe that he ever really thought he could achieve true legitimacy? Or was this just a great con?
No, I think he was really expecting to reach that. He wanted to get in there in order to cancel, kill all the laws that make the justice chase him. So he wanted to get in there just to be protected by the laws that he will help rewrite by threatening other congressists, by threatening other politicians, but from the inside. And not only that, and the most important, I think, he did that because he wanted a respect, a social position that he was always looking for and he never got. Because I think all of this anxiety and rage came from different aspects of his life, I think, but one of them, and one that is very important, was the need of respect, of being respected and seen by the high-class society, to see him like one of them. And he never got that. And because he never got that, he put all the country on their knees in order to respect him. And as in the movie says, as there's a scene at the end that where he's talking to his son, and he says, if you can make people respect you, then make them fear you. And that's what he did. That's what he did, not only to his close family and kids and lovers and associates, but also to the whole country.
How did Pablo get on Virginia's radar to begin with?
Well, she was a very famous and powerful journalist, and they met by accident in a party, and then she was very intrigued about this Robin Hood kind of expert on him, bringing those houses and that help and investing money in the poorest areas of Medellin in Colombia. So she followed him to document that, and then she found this interesting man that was doing some business that back in the day, because now we see it from 2018 with all we know about it, but back in the day it wasn't known what narcotraffic was. It wasn't known what would mean to do business with cocaine at a high level, at a high scale. People were not used to that, so that was a brand new thing, and she was intrigued on that. And then, of course, the passion and the relation happened, and she thought of him as a different person of what he was. That being said, I don't think she was an innocent victim in the sense that she knew who he was and what kind of man he was, and she bought into that as well.
So she knew it, and she bought into it. And she is played by your wife, Penelope mm-hmm. Cruz, in this film. What was it like working with your wife in this particular relationship depicting Pablo and Virginia?
Well, it is way easier than we expected. We were kind of scared to deal with that intense relationship. But it was way easier than we expected, and we enjoy it. Why is that? Because we started very young. She started when she was 16, and I started when I was 17. And we know today how to divide reality from fiction, and we know what it's something based on imagination and what it's real. And we are good in that.
You speak about that intensity of the relationship. When Virginia goes to Miami and she's trying to get away from him, and then she has to come back to Colombia, and she goes and visits him at, you know, La Catedral, the cathedral, mm-hmm. to ask for money. This is the prison that he built. We have a clip of that moment, and it's so incredibly frightening. She says she's seen things.
I would never betray you. It's just that I'm desperate. I don't even know what I'm saying anymore. I'm sorry.
Oh, but abrazo. Don't worry, I will take care of you. I will protect you. I'll make sure you have a long life, eh? Because you know what? I have bad news for you. Nobody will get near you because they will be afraid that I will kill them. So your life is completely full of shit.
So, yeah, that scene.
Yeah, that scene is intense. That scene took us, especially for her, a couple of days to wipe it off our skin. Because, again, we know it's fiction. We know it's... But you have to go there with all the weapons. You put them out there. And it's scary. It's a very tense, scary, hard moment of abuse.
What makes it all the more chilling is the fact that this is a man who actually, and I have to believe at one point, loves this woman. She experienced this love. And then to see your lover threaten you like that, being so weak, that was what was so chilling. And yet, you know, in a lot of ways, he was doing this to all of Colombia. He was the Colombian lover, and he was going after everybody. These scenes of butchery are just, you know, a little bit much sometimes.
That's a great point that you just made. And that's why we wanted to make this, the difference between this Escobar and other readings of Escobar on TV is they make him look cool and funny and powerful. And when we were shooting in Colombia, people were coming to us saying, please don't do that. Don't do that again with this monster, because we don't want our sons to want to be like him. And in this movie, in this one, we have shown the monster. We have shown the broken, painful soul that creates so much harm around him.
Javier Bardem, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Javier Bardem's new film, Loving Pablo, is in theaters now.
Folk music icon Loudon Wainwright is out with a 2-CD box set that's kind of an autobiography in musical form. Find out why now, up next.
This is Press Play. I'm Duarte Geraldino. Loudon Wainwright III has been making music now for nearly 50 years. Here's the first song on his very first album. It came out in 1970.
In Delaware, when I was younger, I would live a life obscene. In the spring, I had great hunger. I was Brando, I was Dean, blaspheming, booted, blue-jeaned baby boy. Oh, how I made them turn their heads.
Loudon Wainwright just released a 2-CD box set that's kind of an autobiography in musical form. It's called Years in the Making, and it comes with a 60-page book of artwork and a bunch of other stuff, like pictures of his birth certificate and a nice note from Johnny Cash, and even his first divorce papers. It's sort of his way of helping you piece together his life. Loudon Wainwright III is here now. Loudon, welcome.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm doing good. So this big project, Years in the Making, how did it come about?
Well, I was, you know, I have this little kind of man cave office thing in the basement of my house, and I just keep looking at all these boxes and boxes of stuff, you know, cassettes and reel-to-reels and bootlegs, and there was so much stuff there that's accrued over the last 50 years or so. I didn't have anything better to do, so I started to go through this stuff. I mean, it also could have something to do with the fact that I'm 72 now, so I'm looking back. Because the what's forward is terrifying, basically. Last year I put out a book called Liner Notes, you know, a memoir. So it's another look back, but I was delighted to find all kinds of interesting stuff that I'd either forgotten about or, you know, hadn't found a home yet, so to speak.
I don't think that your wife likes me. I don't think that your wife likes me. Why do you suppose that that is? I don't know. Maybe it's because I'm famous. Yeah, maybe she's just a little bit jealous. Maybe it's because I was married and now I'm divorced.
This is a pretty big year for you, Loudon. You also have your own Netflix special coming out in November. What's that all about?
Well, that is a thing called Surviving Twin, which is a theater piece that I've been developing for 6 years now, in which I take my songs or some of my songs and combine and connect them with the writing of my my late father, Loudon Wainwright Jr., who was a wonderful, very well-known journalist. He wrote for Life magazine. He had a column in the 60s and 70s and 80s called The View from Here. So I've been performing it and developing it. And then when I did it last year in Los Angeles, my friend Chris Guest, who I've known since the 70s, came. And coincidentally, Judd Apatow was there that night. And they started to talk about the idea of filming it properly with five cameras and, you know, spending a little money on it. And it, lo and behold, they're movers and shakers. And so now this Netflix special is coming out. Yes.
You, your entire life seems to be surrounded by music. You married the late, great folk singer Kate McGarrigle. You had two kids together, Rufus and Martha. Both of them are singers. You were together with another singer, Susie Roach, and the two of you had another daughter, Lucy. She's also a singer. Your sister, Sloane Wainwright, she is also a singer. So when you guys all get together, it sounds something like this song.
Meet the Wainwright on the train, the boat, the bus. Join the family. Come on, rub elbows with us. We're the Wainwright. That's singing family.
For 5 days and five nights, come sample our reality.
Rufus Wainwright.
You remember him?
Once was a man. Now he checks specs out at the gym.
I have a trainer traveling with me on the bus.
Cause he's more famous and much richer than the rest of us. La 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 la. La 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 la.
That song is in a new collection. Was it inspired by a cruise your family took?
Well, the recording that we just played, or you just played, was recorded on a cruise, the singer-songwriter Kayamo Cruise in 2017. And there are plenty of other singer-songwriters, you know, people like Amy Lou Harris and John Prine were there, and John Hyatt, and... So some of us just hit out up on the 14th floor. It was it's a big boat. And others, you know, Steve Earle, he likes to get in and mingle with the people. So he was always out at the salad bar chopping it up with his fans.
So in that particular song, Loudon, there's a lot of harmony, much like a lot of your music. But you're talking about some pretty deep things. And through that song, I get a hint about the family dynamic hasn't always been as harmonious as the actual song. So, for example, Rufus wrote a song, Dinner at 8, about tensions between the two of you.
Dinner at 8 was okay before the toast full of leaves. It was great until those old magazines got us started up again.
Wrote a song about you. I mean, to be frank, I can't even say the name on the air.
I will not pretend, I will not put on a smile, I will not say I'm all right for you, when all I wanted was to be good, to do everything in true, to do everything in true. You bloody mother. Are you bloody mother.
How was it hearing your children write about you, their dad, in that way?
Well, it's always flattering to be written about, I suppose, to be the inspiration, to be their inspiration. And, you know, those are pretty cool songs. And Rufus and Martha and Lucy are terrific, you know, songwriters and performers and stuff. So, yeah, you know, it sometimes it feels a little like the battle of the bands. I mean, I wrote a song called Rufus is a Man when he was about two, and I think that started the ball rolling.
Rufus is a man, sucking on his mama's gland, sucking on the nipple, it's a sweeter than the ripple wine. Yes, it's sweeter than the wine. You can tell by the way the boy burps that it's gotta taste fine.
You know, every family, let me point out, I don't know how things are with your family, but my experience is that just about everybody's family is weird and to a degree dysfunctional. Everybody's got their family things and issues, and I've written about them, and my kids write about them in their songs. And people dig them because, would you believe, their families are screwed up. So it's a good thing to write about, family dysfunction. Great topic.
If you're just joining, you're listening to singer-songwriter Loudon Wainwright III. He has a new box set out called Years in the Making. Now, in this thing that you've produced, this musical set plus that little book, it's a 60-page book with this two-box set. Now, yeah, when I was going through it, it felt like a scrapbook of sorts. And it was fascinating to look through because I felt like I was reading something that I wasn't really supposed to see, like I had snuck in your room, opened your drawer, and found this little book. You even include a copy of your divorce document.
Yeah.
Why do that?
Why not? I mean, I wrote a lot of songs about that situation. You know, that's an important.
So it was proof that it happened.
Yeah. You know, and it's my draft card is there. That happened too. You know,
you wrote a song about that divorce, but it was really more of a song for your kids, Rufus and Martha, and maybe other kids who've been trying to go through this and trying to understand what life will be like for them once their parents get divorced. You titled it Your Mother and I. And there's a live version of it on the new collection, but you have a guitar with you right now.
There's my guitar. It was inspired by my split up with Suzzy Roach. And our daughter Lucy was about three when that happened. But it's apropos for all divorce situations with kids. So here it is, Your Mother and I.
Your mother and I are living apart. I know that seems stupid, but we weren't very smart. You'll stay with her, I'll visit you. At Christmas on weekends, in the summertime too. Your mother and I are not getting along. Somehow, somewhere, something went wrong. Everything changes, time takes its toll. Your folks fell in love. Love's a very deep hole. Your mother and I will do all we can do to work this thing out and to take care of you. Families get broken, I know it's a shame. It's nobody's fault, and you're not to blame. Your mother and I are both feeling bad, but things will get better, they won't stay this sad. And I hope when you grow up, one day you'll see your parents are people, and that's all we can be. Your mother and I
There's a new movie out called Blaze, the one about the little-known country folk artist Blaze Foley.
Uh-huh.
Now, in that film, his close friend, Townes Van Zandt, says, and the quote really sticks with me, he says, if you want to be a folk singer, you have to give up everything, family, security. You just have to burn it all down and take your guitar and go. Is that how you see things?
Well, I knew Townes, and you know, he did burn it down. I mean, but he was a particularly driven guy. I think he's right to a degree. Certainly, personal relationships, family life, it can all suffer when you're out on the road. It takes its toll. Townes really went to the wall, and that's how he did it. I mean, I take a little better care of myself. I used to be pretty abusive with things like alcohol, certainly, but I don't do that as much now. I'm drinking water as we speak, ladies and gentlemen.
As we speak. You know, many artists have this persona that they put forth, essentially the product that they sell, that's different from their personal self. What about you? Do you think there's something different from what we see in your art versus who you actually are?
Well, yeah. I mean, you wouldn't want to see me the way I really am. But there are aspects of who I really am that I emphasize and write about, you know, hopefully crystallize in some way in a song. But yeah, or exaggerate, you know. I mean, it's a version of me that I present. There's a couple of songs on this Years of the Making thing that are go in there, so to speak, and get pretty, I don't know how to put it. But I think I said it before, I like to expose myself. I don't want to get into trouble now. There's no raincoats involved.
Oh, my gosh. Okay. So of these songs, is there anyone in particular that you want to leave us with?
I thought I would maybe play something. It's funny. It's not funny, actually. Things are so weird now. So I thought I'd play something that a lot of people probably haven't heard. It's not on the collection. It's not on Years in the Making, but it's apropos for these times. I wrote this back in February. It's a song called President's Day. We got through Christmas, Thanksgiving too. Halloween wasn't hard, you don't have to be you. But it's there on the calendar, just a few days away. The date I dread in Feb is President's Day.
That's Loudon Wainwright III. His new box set is Years in the Making, and his Netflix special, Surviving Twin, comes out in November.
This year ain't a leap year, so no whoop-de-doo, I'm not even religious. But I'm gonna pray. This year we make it through President's Day. George was the first one, Abe was the best. Libraries and airports named after the rest. But this year I'm queasy about President's Day. There's a nut job in the White House, I'm sorry to say. Hey, in the paper it says.
And I'm Duarte Geraldino. This is Press Play. I'll meet you here again tomorrow.
It's 10% off, so we all ought to go get us a good deal the American way. But my country's a mystery on President's Day.